and welcome to Dateline New Haven, WNHH-FM, your home for community radio in New Haven. This is Paul Bast inviting you to look behind the headlines on the stories that make our community and our world tick.
Yeah, I think we're seeing that, you know, as a sort of mini trend within our own city, but it definitely has been a trend nationwide as well. Just renewed value in cities, just, you know, as we face things like climate change and also issues of equity, just understanding how important cities are in terms of, you know, their capacity to, you know, serve everybody in a way. So really thinking about their capacity to be inclusive. I know in some places where rapid growth has happened, sometimes people get pushed out. So we have to be very mindful about that as well.
You know what's interesting to me about that? Because I remember the very first new urbanist project was Schubert Square, they called it, which is Chapel stuff. And most of the buildings were empty because no one wanted to live there. But I think there were 7 or 8 people living in an SRO who had to be, you know, we didn't want them to be displaced. And that was actually, I was a journalist at something called the New Haven Advocate then, which most people don't remember. And we took up the cause of those 7. One of the women's name was Sally Nywar. And I remember quoting her about how that developer should see how I'm living. And you're right, but in the 60s and 50s, that was done on a scale of like 100 times. But now, is there really that much displacement? Are you really, like, when you build all over either side of Route 34, does anybody have to leave to make room for that?
Yeah, I think urban infill is a great strategy. I mean, I think we do need to be mindful of making sure there's, you know, housing choices for everyone.
So now you're talking about affordable housing, which I do want to bring up later because that's a central part of what we're talking about. But when you're talking about affordable housing, aren't you talking about people not getting priced out and new people being able to find apartments? Or are you also talking about people, because the story of gentrification traditionally is like in New York, a building not in a good shape. A lot of people want to move there. So the landlord comes in and turns off the heat, has loud construction noise at 3 a.m. to drive the tenants away so they get higher paying tenants. They displace people. Are we seeing displacement?
If I can speak for the cars.
Yes, speak for the cars. Yeah, well, someone please speak for the cars.
Yeah. Who will speak for the cars? Someone, please. So, you know, we've seen over the last 10 years a lot of parking lots be repurposed into a higher, better use. Some still with some parking adequately, but for the most part, a lot of the development happening around the city of New Haven presently is on, is, you know, urban infill, as Aisha mentioned.
Filling in highways, filling in parking lots, filling in that lot at Chapel and State. You're right.
Exactly.
And High Street.
We've seen a lot of, you know, underdevelopment still, even to this day, when we have so many thousands of units in progress. We're still underdeveloped. We still have giant surface lots around the corner from here, and we still have more to go.
Okay, and what you're listening to is about the urban re-renewal. New Haven had a big landmark this week in its ongoing quest to fill in empty spaces like highways that were created when neighborhoods were destroyed in the 1950s and 60s. And we're on a roll here in New Haven. And you're listening to that on Dateline New Haven, WNHH New Haven's home for community radio. And we're talking to 3 of the people who might not always be in front of the cameras, but are actually making it happen in city government. Mike Piscatelli, Aisha Woods, and Doug Houseladen. I want to ask a devil's advocate question. Remember earlier I was saying that we all look back and say, like, how could they do that? But I would argue, and you don't have to agree with me, that if we had all been there, we would have done the same thing. So now, since I think we have a consensus now about how it should be, I want to poke at that consensus from with people who don't agree with us. Okay, whenever these lots get filled in, we all say, gee, shouldn't it be a parking lot for people to come in and out of the city? It should be houses and stores and parks, right? Isn't that what we all think?
So I love the question because we talk about it internally as well. It's, you know, sometimes it's the same typology, the physical land use, but what are, you know, what will the history books say about us?
Right.
We don't
right,
address
right.
income inequity, climate change, as Aisha had mentioned. Building typology may be one of the things that we will be criticized for, right? A lot of this is
right.
stick construction versus a more sturdier, you know, building fabric that you saw.
I know the fire department's worried that it's all going to burn down. Yeah.
So it's a lot of, you know, when lumber prices have gone up, so it makes it that much harder to build a, you know, a wood frame construction. So it's, you can kind of see both the angles and the different, you know, sectors around our social and economic well-being that are could impact us as well, because we're not seeing these around the bend and not being as intentional as we could be.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, Mike, can I think what I think I just heard you say? Because you actually put ahead to where I was going to ask you at the end of the show. So you're saying when they look back on us in history, the way we look back now, and say, what did we not see? It sounds like you're saying some of the issues we might get whacked for are, did we have enough affordable housing, as Aisha was saying? Were we thinking enough about climate change, since part of the city might be underwater? And building design, since lumber prices are up and the kind of way buildings being built now, I'm thinking of Spinnaker, for instance, when they put buildings up there, and some of Randy's stuff, like his hotel, it's this one stick construction. I don't pretend to be an expert on it, but we know what it looks like. And I was going to ask you something more fundamental about cars, but that was a great answer, by the way. So I'm always on this side of the new consensus, because just like I would have been drinking the Kool-Aid with Dick Lee, I'm totally drinking the Kool-Aid in New Urbanism. I love what we're doing in New Haven. I love every single thing we're doing in New Haven, okay? But not everybody does, and they might be right, right? So when we started filling in Route 34, the rest of the highway that never got built was a median strip. We still got rid of the businesses, but we never put anything else there. So finally, we got control to have our destiny. We're trying to do it block by block. We built a whole bunch of stuff across from Career High School, right? And in one case, it was a Rite Aid. And the Rite Aid has a parking lot.
And a drive-through.
And I remember arguing with somebody who was really upset about that. And I said, because they were like an architect, I won't give a name, you know, like architectural purist, I'll call the person, you know, like. So I said, and I love the person a lot. I said, you know, people work at that Rite Aid. They come at 3 a.m. They're not going to get a bus home, right? So they're saying, well, we should have shuttles. We should, and you have to put shuttles in some places when you're trying to build there to get people their jobs at New Haven. But there's still a reality that, as Doug said, 80% of people drive to work. And even if they don't do that in the city center, people come to the job at Rite Aid and they have kids. Even if it's not 3 a.m, they have to pick up their kids when they come off their shift. They're earning like low wage. They can't afford, you know, they got some junky car. They got to park it and pick up people. So is there a way, in addition to the very important big issues you raised, Mike, about how we might be looked at 50 years from now of having made mistakes, do you think that we're a little bit too purist about cars? Doug, Mike?
So let's take it broader than cars, because I think we'll always love our car.
And by the way, and it's a given,
or
right?
Or something that's personal to us.
Well, I don't actually. I mean, it's a given we wish everyone could get around easily on bus, right, and train. We wish that.
Yeah. Everything goes sort of the increments of life, right? So it's important to have the aspiration out there, or you never make the incremental changes. Mm. So that's what's so important about making sure we always have a high bar in this city. And that as city staff, you know, we're technicians. We operationalize this stuff. Unless someone sets the bar high, we'll never push our envelopes.
Right.
So with the project that was launched on Monday, there's less than 100 parking spaces on site. Doug and Carter did a great job figuring out how to better share the Temple Street garage and the Temple Med garage. Otherwise, we would have, you know, had a groundbreaking with a big parking garage on that project.
That's right. There was no parking
garage. So instead, it's the big plaza. It's a big public space that'll be built with this project. So it's a big incremental step forward from 100 College Street. And if we do it right, the next project, Parcel B, will be one more step further. Maybe taller, maybe more dense. Maybe.
And as we get more toward the very center, it's always understood that things are denser there and that there is more access to public transit. Can I just translate a little bit what you said for our listeners who might not follow the stuff day to day? I think what you're saying, the reason we didn't have we would have in the past always had a parking garage that we were partly breaking ground on, but we didn't do that this week. And you said you did that partly by finding ways to free up more spaces at existing garages a block away. Is that what you did?
Yep.
Yeah. So the parking system has a capacity, and when you're at capacity, you can also balance that capacity around. So our parking.
What does that mean?
So the New Haven Parking Authority manages about 14,000.
Oh, that's right. You run that too.
Parking spaces. And one of our largest customers, Yale New Haven Health, has been moving into the downtown, moving east in their needs for additional parking and shuttles. And through a couple multi-year collaboration with the hospital and the development, we're able to relocate some of that hospital parking to the west and free up parking in the east. That parking will be needed in 2021. It's not needed yesterday. It's not needed tomorrow. It's needed in about 2 years as the leasing starts up.
And is this where you're going to be putting people on the Route 34 land that's past the connector and then giving them a shuttle to work?
Well, we will be continuing to solve for the hospital needs, for their mobility needs, to service the number one employer in the state of Connecticut. It's also important to mention the challenge. They have their two largest campuses here, and that's what we're also trying to service as a regional hospital system.
And soon they'll have the neuroscience center, although they do have parking for that.
And they do have some additional parking that will be constructed. And again, with the planning, proper planning And theoretically, you know, with demand changing a little bit, we'll be seeing what happens in 2 years. But we're, as we told Gateway Community College this morning, we're ready for all of this action. And the activity is all possible from years of planning and working it out and figuring out how best to accommodate, rather than a parking garage, a public plaza.
And I think it also speaks to a faith that, a faith in live where you work. So to really get beyond this model of, you know, a commuter town and really have the jobs in New Haven, in walking distance, in the neighborhoods close by, so that people can get to their jobs, you know, without a car commute.
And these residents, the over 1,700 people walk to the Yale School of Medicine every day for work. So that's a lot of folks that are also creating biotech IP, following it along,
IP,
intellectual property, and following that along into making businesses out of it. Those are the type of people that want to have a new urbanist experience.
So now we're talking big picture here, which I love to do. Like, where are we going? What are our aspirations here on Dateline New Haven, WNHHFM, with Doug Housley and Aisha Woods and Mike Piscatelli? You also, I would imagine, tell me if I'm wrong, your job also, while you're trying to keep the big picture and the details of getting a project over, is the complaints you hear from the public are often very immediate, right? So while you're talking about where you want New Haven to be in a year, in 10 years, I would guess that the people who are very mad at you right now are trying to get to I-95 tomorrow, right? So in other words, to fill in this highway, we have to temporarily close streets. And boy, do you guys do a lot of work on this. I mean, you give us so much great information about where the temporary detours will be. But sometimes people have to know, when they're frustrated in traffic, that the reason you're going to be disconvenienced for 6 months is because we want to make it better for 60 years. Is that a fair way to put it? And if so, what are you telling the people when they're pulling their hat out and saying, Mike, Doug, Aisha, I'm trying to get to the highway. I got to, like, go around Lafayette Street past the old plaza. Then it's all backed up and it's one block. And then I got to remember to go left. And there's only one lane in front of the other building, the building next to the towers. What do you tell people? I know that part of the answer is you just put out a lot of good information. And it is good information about how you get there.
So thanks for the question. First off, we take that very meaningfully, personally, to me. You know, we're residents as well, right?
And one thing you three are so good at, I've noticed, is you don't take it personally, because people get mad. They make it personal, right? You know, like, when they're stuck in traffic, they're going to be mad at you, right?
So first, I have not received one complaint on this detour.
Yeah. Oh,
so credit to the team in terms of the quality of the, you'll have to send them over by email.
Oh, not the quality, not how you did it.
On the complaint?
The fact of it.
Okay. Oh. It's hard, right?
Yeah.
It's difficult. I think I would suggest we research this a lot with phase one to figure out how the anxiety of closing these exit ramps, where will traffic back up? We'll go back up all the way to the main line of the highway. The anxiety was really significant with phase one. We ran all the way back beyond the traffic to the meaningful nature of the change in the economy here.
Oh, like where are people
to
working?
Connect to the jobs, to the people that were coming here for very specific economic reasons, that you could create a space and a place that was very meaningful globally for our economic development position. And so that's why you heard even at the groundbreaking about Wusai, about our Venice, about
Wusai is again that neuroscience research thing.
About the science behind that. And that almost like if you were in a town with a big sports team, there's passion and there's emotional attachment to that team. In some ways, you see the New Haven community getting much more attached to what's happening here. And the difference it's making in the world.
The most interesting interview I did during the pandemic was the guy who was running that Institute for Yale. The questions they're asking about how we think and how our brains are changing as technology changes. It's really fascinating.
So. In 2 or 3 years, it's conceivable you'll have a group in here about quantum computing and what's happening at QCI out up at Science Park. And it's that inspiration that I think in some ways, so you start there.
You start
and
by
then
telling
you walk
people
through the journey to get there through the infrastructure work, and then what it results in at the end of the day. And you sort of create that pattern, and I think it helps people connect to what's happening. Or at one presentation, we used Biohaven, which hired Khloe Kardashian to sell their product on. People could relate to it.
What I mean is, so I want to make sure I understand what you just said. So when people are getting mad, why is it so hard to drive? And how are you doing this temporarily? Are you saying that you first try to put it in the context for people of the new economy we're building and what kind of cool city we're becoming?
And then ways to get around, and not just by car, transit, walk, all of the different ways that you can get around our city, a much bigger network than where the exact detour is, and then being incredibly honest and transparent about what's next.
So one
people
theory,
can follow the pattern of you know, month to month, week to week, about what their community is going to be like.
And so you were closing a exit at a time of what I think it was four exits?
Three.
So we're doing one at a time. So when you did the first one, the first morning, I stood outside Gateway College. So a lot of people had to get off sooner and they were pissed. It was backed up. Second morning, there were a lot fewer. So the theory is, I guess, Doug, this is what you spend your life in, is that it takes a day or two when people figure out a new way to get around. Is that true?
Yes, and the human being is a very intelligent being that will figure it out, especially for commuters. They're going to be doing the same thing over and over and over again. With our commute habits that have changed drastically in the last year, as well as summer schedule being lower, we've seen a real good amount of space in the detour to handle the volume of cars.
So in other words, you think they're working. Always, like I was talking to myself in Westville, he's a doctor, he goes to Brantford. So I told him, I thought, he and I watched your video. Doug did a video for us about how you do the new detour to get on the highway. And he almost got hit by a car, but he kept calm. I thought that was pretty good. I said, that looked pretty simple to me. You just go around the old College Plaza and then turn left. Or you still go down George and then turn right on Church. He said it gets really backed up there. And that he thinks the thing to do is to go all the way down State Street and go to Wooster Street.
Alternative options. There's a lot of ways to get to the highway still, even without South Thrunage Road being available. But I think most important is communicating those options ahead of time and creating the network effect.
Was he right that it made sense to go all the way to Westville to Wooster Street? I thought that was crazy. Why not go to Kimberly?
It depends on where you're going. And so the most important thing is to have an option, right? Mm-hmm. And so to have a network effect. What we did in the project as a team was, and you know, kudos to the engineering department over the last year, sprinted to reopen Columbus Avenue. That's a roadway that's been closed for 60 years, and that's taking 2,000 cars a day.
So who drives? And then just so people know, that's from Church Street South, the street, not the old development, to the train station. There's a street that got closed off. No one quite knows how long ago, or maybe you do, but it got reopened now. Mm-hmm. But someone asked me, who's taking that? I figured it was people going to the train station didn't want to go all the way around to Union Ave.
There's still a lot of surface lots and a lot of parking in the medical district. There's about 2,000 cars that's the best access to the highway. That's the Washington Ave lots, the Cedar Street parking garage, as well as the 800 parking spaces at 100 Church Street South, the only high school.
So they can get on the highway that way. So that's right. Just in this very specific idea, because Doug has people tweeting him middle of the night, and he actually gives them routes to get places. I mean, it's pretty amazing. Yeah. So I'm asking about the specific one. Because I told
Commutes are very personal.
I told my friend he was nuts.
Where'd he come from?
Westville. He's going to Brantford. I said, there's no way you have to go all the way from Westville to Wooster Square to get an I-95, that it would seem like Kimberly Square would be quicker, or even that detour on College Street. Was he right and I'm wrong? Is he smarter?
Well, you're both very intelligent. I'm sure of it. You've chosen New Haven as your place of residence.
So definition, ergo.
So for 95 North, the best option, depending on where you are in Westville, will be taking Elm Street over to Trumbull or heading over to Route 10 to get onto Kimberly. I like Kimberly, especially for anyone who doesn't enjoy merging on the highway.
Oh, he thought that was bad because you go out of your way. Kimberly doesn't feel out of the way.
It's not actually out of the way. If we look at a map, our north, south, east, west is all off.
And it goes east.
And it goes east.
All right. And we're here on WNHH-FM, New Haven's home for community radio, with three people who are putting the new urban renewal into place in New Haven, Mike Piscatella, Aisha Woods, and Doug Houseland. So I was kind of proud the way people like us were proud a half century ago because they thought they were making the new city, right? To look at the New York Times a week before your groundbreaking, they had a story, they said close to 30 to make it sound big, I think it was about 28 cities, are trying to fill in highways just like us. And only four have started to do it, and we were one of the four. Do you hear about that from places? Do people say, wow, you guys are ahead of this? Or you ever go to a conference, Aisha, and said you guys are on top of this?
I think more and more, particularly with the change in administrations in Washington, you're starting to see a movement that had started, you know, maybe picked up in earnest in the early part of the Obama administration. And now it's really picking up. And there are a number of factors related to it, right? The age of the old viaducts, the cost of maintaining, whether or not we still need these, you know, systems in the middle of towns, plus the social and economic push to actually make it happen. We're really fortunate, right? Like, we might be still in the bullpen of projects moving forward had we not had the economic push to really mash the grant writing ass, the cost benefit analysis, the rationale for doing this.
Were we ready sooner than other cities because our meds and eds and meds economy was happening faster because the investments of Yale and Yale New Haven and things like that. So people like Mike Bitzel and Aisha and Doug were thinking about how do you get this money and draw up the plans before some other cities were?
I think in part because of the location too, right? Where this particular expressway is relative to the hospital and the medical district. So even at Alexion early on, you had the faculty at the School of Medicine that might have a relationship with Alexion and also over at the hospital do rounds maybe at one point in the day. In another part of the day, you're teaching a class. The other part of the day, you're over at a private lab. So that walkability, the need to be very close and proximate, was really one of the early drivers of how we had to move faster on 34.
Did you folks have reactions to that story? Is the national picture right? This is a trend. It's a good thing. New Haven's ahead of the game. Although they said it was a little complicated in Rochester.
Yeah, right. We've looked at, I mean, we like to look at other cities to see how they're doing it. I would say, and this project has, you know, as you mentioned at the top, has predated all of us. So I really, you know, the sort of national focus on this project, I think, has been over, again, it has been, you know, over a larger team. Mm-hmm. I do want to call out that the project did win a Women in Engineering Award this year.
Really?
That naming Donna Hall as a project that was
wonderful.
Led
she's
by
been here for a long time.
Yeah, and she's really the project lead on the infrastructure
Go
piece
Donna.
Of this. Yeah.
So she's so an engineer?
She's a project manager, and she's working with our engineer consultants.
Oh, that's terrific.
Yeah, so the project has received national attention in that way.
So when we talk, oh, Doug?
Yeah, I would just say I remember a 2007 presentation at Career High School with the former mayor of Milwaukee and the Congress of New Urbanism.
Norquist.
Mayor Norquist.
He's a Republican, right?
I'm not sure, but he came and talked about highway removal, and I remember being so excited.
I remember that.
This is my first public meeting I ever attended, I think, was that meeting. And
John
so this
Norquist.
Is 14 years ago, we're talking about this, and Mike's there, you know, Kelly Murphy and the DeStefano administration have been, you know, that probably took years to get that ready, you know. This is all very much going all the way back to Smilo, 2003.
Hospital at New Haven.
They can all the way back to probably the late 90s when people have been rethinking this and thinking this again. And
well, we started New Urbanism in New Haven with the Schubert Project, the Chapel College Project in 1982.
Like the early,
I think also people are really taking another look at the kind of racial pattern of federal highway transportation footprint.
Like, in other words, they disproportionately wrecked black neighborhoods, low-income neighborhoods,
exactly.
And that's the people who got dispossessed.
Exactly, and people are looking at that much more closely now, so.
Okay, I see if I could transition here. So we're talking, I think it's fair to put this filling in the highway, and the other stuff we're talking about, the larger bucket of how you rebuild a city, whether we want to call it new urbanism, urban renewal. And really at the forefront of that is, I think you're personally, and working with Mike and Doug and others, rewriting our zoning code and hoping it gets approved, right? Which is a big deal, right? The idea is that our zoning rules were out of date and were based on how we thought we should rebuild cities 50, 60 years ago, when we thought like buildings should have one purpose, not three, right? And we shouldn't mix it all together. So you have two major proposals, if I'm correct, that have recently been introduced, one of which was debated last night, Wednesday night, about making it more possible to have more people living on a block, because making it easier to have what we call mother-in-law apartments or converting garages to apartments, ADU is the phrase. And then the other big change is about affordable housing, that the other proposal you just introduced, to have it requirements. People are building so much in New Haven, they're required that at least some percentage of a building that's going up, especially in the center city, have affordable rents. That accurate?
Correct. Those are the two initiatives that we have before the Board of Alders right now. And we are planning to also keep moving in terms of looking at right sizing or zoning to both our existing fabric and what our future growth trajectory
And of course,
look
parking
like.
Fits in with that, right?
Parking
Doug,
fits in.
That we're saying you don't need so many parking spaces when you put up a building because not everybody's going to drive.
Yeah, parking often comes back to parking.
Drives development.
In terms of, it both drives development and people feel very passionate about parking. It impacts their daily experience, you know, maybe twice a day.
And Mike talked about expectations. Yeah. Like, it used to be like she'd be able to park right in front of a place right on the street. You know, you don't want to go in a garage. And it's so interesting. I know some of the pushback we're getting about the changes comes from some of the neighborhoods or names we want to do it, which is why we have a public process. So, for instance, the most opposition I've, because, you know, when you say do these ADUs, mother-in-law apartments, you know, garages, most people say, great idea. You know, that's how we can keep it cheaper. And so you can afford to stay in New Hallville or the Hill. But people in the Hill, some people are quite upset about it. We had an article about a management team because they're saying it's already too crowded. I hear next door when someone's flushing the toilet, or and we can't park. We do have cars, working class people. We can't get out to Universal Drive or to a job where the jobs really are with a bus. So they actually were opposing the idea, saying we don't want it to become more crowded. Is that a representative message? Because you can't say who speaks at a meeting is really whether that represents what everybody thinks. Given that one of the criticisms of urban renewal, right or wrong, this new book suggests it's not as bad as people thought, that it said it doesn't really let people who are affected weigh in on policy, and you guys do public hearing after public hearing after public hearing, you know, kind of goes in the other direction of how many. Is that the real popular sentiment? How do you judge what you heard last night?
So I think last night represented I think there's going to be many different feelings about this. And last night represented, you know, a sample of those. And I think it's really important to listen to each of them, you know, and really, you know, reflect on the things that we heard and see if there's, you know, look at our draft, which is a draft, right, and see how things should be balanced.
So what does this make us think about the idea that it's good if we have it easier for people to have more people living on their property? Does this make you think we shouldn't do that, or that we have to have things in place to make sure that there's still enough parking around? Like, what's the outcome?
We're starting with a very incremental approach. So the first approach really has no physical impact on the landscape. It doesn't increase, you know, building mass, or it doesn't add new building. It simply allows you to, you know, subdivide an existing dwelling or to convert an existing accessory building.
And that's what ADU is, accessory dwelling unit.
Yeah, exactly. And we would, you know, we would be looking at how we could make it, you know, expand the program, but really with some design guidelines that are specific to those on the ground conditions. So obviously there's things about, you know, if it's a very small lot, it may not be appropriate to, there may be a lot coverage ratio that we want to maintain. But we just really need to take the time and get the public feedback before we set those.
You know, it's so hard to then make a decision in the end, because it's so hard. When I look back, and my mind changes so often when I look back the last round, the last two rounds we did this, about how hard it is to know what, quote, the public thinks. Mm. On the one hand, if you show up, your voice does get heard more, and I don't know that that's bad. But sometimes you only show up because you're mad rather than being happy, or because you're not busy because you're going to work. So I don't know. If you, Mike, had any thoughts?
A little bit of all of that, right? And what? I think, you know, to the points made, I mean, these are leading citizens in our community, people who have lifted the Hill for many, many years, Mr. Dye, Miss Hatley.
So I would never do anything Mr. Dye doesn't want me to do.
Same here. Yeah, you know, and I think, you know, the voices and perspectives all create a better product at the end. The worst thing we could do is rush, right? Try to force it, try to be a little bit more righteous, all that sort of stuff. Listen, improve the draft, keep doing it in an iterative sort of way. Mm-hmm. It's going to take some time, you know, and if you live in the Hill, which is arguably one of the most dense neighborhoods anywhere in the state, and what are some of the problems we're trying to solve are statewide problems, right? There's not a significant push for affordable housing in the suburbs, in the rural areas. So those pressures build in a lot of the areas where they've carried quite a bit of everything for so long and made such inclusive communities. And here comes city staff, one more thing, we do one more thing, because we have these great needs that are out there. So the worst thing we could do is rush, and even worse than that is not listen. So I think last night's hearing was the start of a very important journey.
And of course, I think we all agree, one thing we love about New Haven is how much people care.
Yeah.
People Democracy's care. Messy, absolutely. It is the best mess. When I was talking about like how you judge, so Johnny Dye, he's always been charged with community management teams, Block Watch. We have this really interesting network of community management teams in New Haven. So they were created during community policing start in 1990. It was really supposed to be cops meet with the neighborhood. Quickly became the way that a developer goes there to find out what organized neighbors think. You guys go to unveil plans on the early stages and hear back. Do you think we're lucky in New Haven that while there's no perfect way to judge what democracy is and not everybody can come to a meeting, do you agree with me that this has sort of given us this very interesting way of having a democratic, one of many democratic ways of finding out what people think? Like, Doug, when you have plans, is that what you want to hear? Mike, Aisha?
There are times people might stop in, particularly our peers from elsewhere, and just talk about, see the top level of what's happening. Oh, you're taking out the highway. Oh, new buildings going up. This is happening. All that sort of stuff. And I think over the years, we've learned to slow those conversations down and to talk about what the ground game looks like here. 30 members of the Board of Alders. We have neighborhood specialists that are out in every district, right? We have a real big focus on anti-blight and working on neighborhood issues, if you will. And it's the ground game that almost unlocks a lot of the other opportunity, if you will, because if we are not taking care of what matters every day, then how could you ask that same group of people to think big about taking out a highway, moving your route to work, you know, adding more dwelling units in a neighborhood that's already a little bit stressed in terms of density? You just can't get to that next level of conversation. So to us, it was very inspiring that the Hill Alders, Abby Roth as well, the downtown Alder, spoke on Monday, because that perspective is not always coming to the forefront, either in other cities.
They were the stars.
Recording in progress.
I thought that was one of the inspirations of that groundbreaking was the Hill Alders. Ron Hurt, especially, he's an Alder in the Hill. He has this. He preaches, and when he talked about a kid growing up in the Hill, how a kid was affected by the old urban renewal decisions and how the deal made to include construction jobs and classrooms in the biotech building, what that means, the opportunity and how a neighborhood's involved in development. I thought that was sort of like the killer point of that event.
The Alders informed a lot of that program, and Carter took it very seriously. We did as well. We think the classroom's going to be very, very special. That in fact, you know, students could walk into the front door of that building just like everybody else and go to the classroom and be part of the experience and not be on the
outside. I hadn't
thought
about that part. If you're a high school kid in the city and you have this gleaming office tower with a world involved pharma company and you're going in there every day because you have a lab there working with the company, I wonder if that psychologically affects you when you decide what's possible for you to do when you make your next steps in life.
AstraZeneca will be on the building there, you know, assuming with the Alexion takeover. That's a global name at this point.
Not a great name at the moment, but we'll talk about that another day. Every headline, including today's at the
bottom. One of our sector specialists, when we were really trying to figure out the bio path, and you know, there was no degree in New Haven for you to actually get a degree in the biosciences before we did phase one. So that was Southern, Gateway, Albertus was involved in public schools. But one of the things our sector specialist says was, you have to remember, you know, in high school, the kids take their backpack and they throw it up on the lab table. Because it's like any other class, right? But the rigor in these scientific fields is such, keeping your notebook, the discipline around the lab environment is taught at a lab. It's taught in a professional setting. It's not going to be taught necessarily in your high school setting. Mm-hmm. So we'll see how that plays out. But we're very excited.
When I got to work in a newsroom in high school, daily paper, that just changed my entire life. Where I could walk in, how I could do it, how I felt about myself. So yeah. So before I let Aisha Woods and Mike Piscatelli and Doug Houselading leave on this episode of Dateline New Haven WNHH, I want to ask you one more in the weeds question about in the past when we did urban renewal, things didn't work out the way we thought with the best of intentions. How do we avoid that happening again? And that's on the new proposal to require developers, when they're building a new building, to include a certain percentage of affordable rents in there. So it's not just people who have more money who get to live there. As you know, and we all love that goal, right? That's the big goal. There's a movement that started in California from affordable housing advocates who argue with other affordable housing advocates to the death that you should never require anything. That the idea is build, build, always say yes. Because the more they build, the more supply there will be. So that will drive down rents elsewhere. The idea being, when everyone was saying, well, you're building all these new market rate apartments on Howe Street on lots, and those are going to have high rents, so where poorer people are going to live or middle class. Other people who from that camp responded, build twice as many because then on Dwight Street a block away, the rents won't go up as much because there won't be as demand. But then there are other people who say, that's theory. In real life, you're creating more of a demand. And then there's a third camp which isn't sure, which is me, who thinks back to the 1990s when we built all these condos in Fairhaven and Fairhaven Heights in New Haven. They were all for people who had a good amount of money, and they built too many. So in the end, we actually had new Section 8 housing. We had a lot of new condos for teachers and cops. So maybe the market plays itself out. Where are you in that current debate? Because you just put a proposal to require developers, if they want to build, to have affordable housing in there. Are the people in California wrong?
You know, I mean, the proposal is based on a very specific pro forma that inputs construction costs, it inputs rents, it inputs operation costs. So there's some very rigorous math behind the feasibility study.
Meaning that they can still afford to do it and not have to charge the other people $1 million for their apartment.
Or, I mean, it has to be very carefully balanced so that the last thing we want to do is slow down housing production. I fully agree with that viewpoint that we don't want to slow down housing production. And so that has to be very carefully calibrated, and there have to be some incentives for developers to help them make up, you know, any financing gap or, you know, to make their projects pencil out. But on the other hand, I think it's really important to provide, you know, an inclusive environment downtown where these new market rate apartments are going up. I often, on the bus, when we stop next to the Audubon, I've heard numerous times, you know, people on the bus inquiring about those apartments, and the answer is always, oh, those are way too expensive. Like, there's no way you'd ever be able to afford to live there. So not to pick on any particular development, it's just that's where I take the bus.
See, part of me wonders, like, so, Winchester Avenue, they have those expensive apartments. I'm just, like, betting that it'll be just like all those Fairhaven developments. So some New York investor, in this case, the owner of the Nets Stadium, he'll take a hit on his taxes, maybe, maybe not, and the rents will go down $1,000 a month the way they did in Fairhaven. Like, I'm not a free market guy, but I'm just wondering whether these free market advocates might have a point.
Well, one of the things we've built in flexibility into the plan so that we would, you know, do another analysis on a biannual.
But I think what I'm hearing
basis
from you is that you don't have to be a purist on either end. You're saying you're looking to make the economics work so they can still build the housing. I mean, another way they did it, John DeStefano, when he was mayor, he actually had Liberty Community Services have supportive housing for the homeless right in the Ninth Square, where upscale housing was going a block away, and then the McCormick Barron, Beacon Properties were sort of a mix. So we have done it with a mix in downtown.
Yeah.
But I guess one reason I admire what you do, and I'm glad I get to be a journalist who doesn't really have to take a stand in the end, because then there are consequences, is you actually have to make a decision at the end of the day about how all this stuff works. But it seems like you really have studied it up and you're working hard, and we're on a good track in the day, right? Say that's fair.
Appreciate the time. Appreciate the fact that so many people have gone on the journey with it. As we mentioned, we're sort of like representatives of this big, broader team. And a lot more still to do as we go forward. So the feedback matters, even maybe when we're a little bit more distant, to make sure people are in touch. So if you hear something, let's all speak up and kind of be a voice in the room.
All right. So let me put on our closing music. You guys are guinea pigs a little bit today. We're after the pandemic, we're transitioning back to in-person radio here at WNHH. So it was really nice to have you guys in person. It was really a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having us.
Mike Piscatelli, Economic Development Director, City of New Haven. Aisha Woods, the City Plan Director. And Doug Houselading, the Transit Director with a very long title. Do you feel like saying the whole title? We have a few minutes.
Transportation, Traffic, and Parking.
No, there's more than that, right? is it Director or Executive Director?
I'm the Executive Director for the New Haven
Department. And plus you have to add your parking authority. Okay, we'll do that next episode. We'll do a whole episode devoted to Doug's title. Okay. Anyway, thanks for joining us today on WNHHFM's Dateline New Haven. It was a real pleasure to talk to you. And this is Paul Bass signing off and saying fly free with us all night at WNHHFM 103.5.